Welcome to another episode of... I like this name when we started. Now I feel slightly awkward using it. It feels slightly childish. I think it was something like John and Jim's Excellent Journey. I'm sure you guys will know this more than I do, because it'll be probably sitting in front of your player, whatever it is, as a title, and searing into your heart as it is searing into mine. This is our third one. I believe two will have been up by the time you hear the third one, which is why it is the third one rather than the second one. Today, again, John Kenneth Muir here is here from his world in America's Own. I couldn't think of any other way to call it. I suppose I could have said from over in America, in the Carolinas, but no, I went with America's Own. And there's me here in the James Zone over here in the here place. And we're talking today about something that people don't really talk about much, I don't think, and that is not specifically The Fugitive, but we're looking at that sort of fugitive model, which has been quite pervasive within the sort of, within American television within the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Right. Fascinating topic, James.
It is, and it's as usual, it's right up your street, being both American 60s, 70s, and 80s. And shows that you love involved in this. In fact, you've introduced me to a show I'd never heard of before that was involved in this as well, which we will talk about in a second. So I just wondered, what did you have any feelings, or did you want to talk about this model? I mean, I say The Fugitive as the sort of forerunner, but of course nothing ever is the forerunner. I mean, do you know of any that spring to mind that precursor The Fugitive?
Well, I think when we talk about The Fugitive, what we're really talking about is this kind of formula and how this formula became extremely efficacious for other TV show creators to use. It was a format, essentially.
Yes.
And you had all these pieces, all of these character types. And, you know, going back, say, was there one on TV before The Fugitive? And I don't think there was one on TV, but I think...
Yes.
...types... come from Les Miserables, and the character type I call the hapless pursuer, of course, is I'm terrible pronouncing these names, Javert. You know, we have Kimball is Valjean. You know, that it takes something, I think, from that, which isn't take something from very source, but then transplants it into the America Zone, James.
Into the America Zone.
The America Zone into American television, so much that it was a staple formula for 3 decades. Maybe there might have even been one in the 90s called The Visitor, which was like in the heyday of The X-Files, where we were again in this sort of a very button-down format with characters we know, doing things we understand, going on this journey. The Fugitive, I mean, I'm glad that this format is not used widely now, because I think that, you see it a couple times and you sort of get the idea of it, and it's almost more a soap opera format than a, mythology or science fiction or horror format. But so many science fiction shows have adopted it since The Fugitive.
I suppose the question is as you say, I mean, when did The Fugitive start? It was, he says...
1963 to 1967, and it was one of the most popular series on the air, if not the most popular at the time. And the final episode in which the fugitive, Dr. Richard Kimball, caught his prey, the person he was chasing, the one-armed man, right? That would went through the roof as far as ratings were. I mean, it was a huge event on television. It was like a TV series back then actually had an ending. You know, it wasn't just canceled and you're left wondering what was going to happen. The Fugitive was a major pop culture event of the 60s. And it's funny because today we think, oh, well, Lost in Space or Star Trek or, even Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Those were the major pop culture events of the 60s. But I think for the people living it, what they were really thrilled about was The Fugitive. That was a high-rated show.
People took time off work, didn't they, for the final episode. There was people who actually took the day off. There's, as you say, these other shows, especially Lost in Space, Star Trek, had actually had lulls at the end. They both dropped in the ratings and, as you say, were removed. But this was very different. I think what is interesting, and perhaps why I sort of say, you know, see it as an originator, is as you say, the format was original in the sense that television by 63 was still a fairly new beast. I mean, you're only really talking about, you know, just over a decade of it being a sort of serious thing for America, certainly. And so you're mixing in this on the run sort of trope or sort of genre, which, as you say, is prevalent. You could sort of take Les Miserables. You could even look even sooner. I mean, you could look at most of a lot of Hitchcock stuff. Certainly, North by Northwest, which was a few years before that, where you've got the misaccused person on the run from some antagonist. That sort of format was very much there in the cinema. There's a thriller. It was quite a commonish, well, certainly looking back historically, it pops up quite common in the classics.
It would have been familiar.
It would have been familiar. 39 Steps, again, has that similar sort of vibe. But what is different is when you get to television, as you say, is that you can do this as a sort of procedural thing, which each week your protagonist is in doing the same thing, but in a slightly different situation, in a slightly different location. It's almost like an anthology has gone to a travel agent and taken a trip to the procedural, or the other way around. I can't work out which way it is. But it is, because each episode is in itself its self-contained thing, while it still has this running strand of this story arc, which in most cases never gets completed. As you say, in The Fugitive, it did. But it does make it very compelling. What makes it compelling to John Kenneth Muir?
Well, I think what makes it compelling is the idea that these characters inevitably give up their lives and everything they know to go on the run. These are, I mean, some people call these like man on the run or character on the run shows. I mean, that's what it is. And the thrilling thing is, you know, each week it's a new situation, a new city, a new locale. Oh, look, this week it's going to be on a ranch and be a Western. Oh, but this week we're going to be with motorcycle gangs. You know, it's an opportunity to do something fresh every week. But I think it grows tiresome very quickly because certainly at our vantage point in history, we've seen enough TV to know that you're never really going to make any progress towards your solution. I mean, The Fugitive is one of the few that did. Essentially, you're on the run, but it's an eternal on the run. You're not actually solving the problem. If you look at all of these short-lived, you know, fugitive knockoffs, that very few of them resolve. And so, you know, the goal of every TV show is to basically last forever. So what you're doing is really just, like you said, having an anthology where you have one character going into a different type location each week, which becomes tiresome because you say, well, hey, where's the one-armed man, or where's Starman, where's his wife that he's looking for, or where is Bennu's partner, her sarcophagus that's buried somewhere in the Phoenix that he's looking for. You know, if you break down the format of The Fugitive, if you break down these elements, I mean, you just see how rote they are. I mean, we have so we always have the man or woman on the run. That's our hero. That's, you know, David Banner on the Hulk. That's Bennu in the Phoenix. That's the man with immortal blood and the immortal whose name I can't remember. Is it Don Richards? Right? Ben Richards was his name. We have our central character who's on the run and who's being chased. Okay, and then we have like truly the worst character type in history, which I call the hapless pursuer. You know, and that's, you know, Barry Morse in The Fugitive, Lieutenant Gerard. And the reason I say he's such a horrible character is because on a weekly basis, this character can't get anything done. I mean, this is somebody who's devoted their whole life to chasing the man on the run. This is Jack McGee in The Hulk, Don Knight's character Fletcher in The Immortal. You know, this person, their whole personhood, their whole whatever gestalt is to chase down and bring this person to justice, okay? Preminger in The Phoenix, I think, was his name. And that was, was it Richard Lynch who played him? But, you know, all of these characters, all they have to do is chase down and capture this person. And every week, every single week, they're foiled and can't do it.
But that's kind of beautiful. Just if I just interject, because I just thought about this. This was kind of beautiful about it is because they are so disconnected, the chaser, the pursuer, and the pursued, and yet they're so interconnected because they're both utterly hindered by the storyline, because the story doesn't want to let the person actually vindicate themselves, nor does it want the person chasing them to vindicate themselves either.
Right.
So they are constantly battling the same obstacles as the narrative goes on. But they're the same.
They are, absolutely. I mean, you break this down and, you see that they can't really get together because then it's over. But like every now and then, like, there'll be intimation that they are going to meet each other, and they're going to be together for a short time, or they'll be trapped or something together, and then they'll help each other get out, and then they're back to chasing and escaping each other. But after a while, it just becomes so insanely predictable because you realize it's never going to resolve. Logan's Run, the series, Logan is a man on the run series in a way. You have Francis from the City of Domes chasing Logan and Jessica every week. And at some point, those characters like Francis become insipid because you think, why don't you just like shoot Logan, and throw him in the trunk and drive him back? There's one episode of that series which I think epitomizes it, and I can't remember the title. I know Marriott Hartley is in it, who I love, and she's in love with the Android Ram. But she's like running a sleep clinic in the post-apocalyptic 23rd century. And Francis gets there, and he shoots her, and he's gonna arrest Logan and bring back. And Logan's like, "Oh, here, put on this headset, and you can contact Sanctuary." And of course he puts it on, and it's like the sleep headset, and it puts him to sleep, and they escape. And you think, "Oh, Francis, you're an idiot. You're such an idiot. Why did you do that? Why did you put on the headset? Why didn't you just say no, Logan? And shoot Logan in the leg, or something like that." The after a while, you just realize that the game is up. You understand the format so well. You think it's never going to happen. So really, I'm just wasting my time watching these scenes with you, making plans to, expose the Hulk, or catch Starman, or catch Logan.
That's what's always so funny, because the protagonist is also doing those same sort of things where he could almost get the cure for his gamma disease, but he goes and saves someone. You think, if you just left that person alone, or if you didn't go near them and just gone straight in there, sorted that out, then gone back out, you have those same sort of twists that are affecting both these components that are stopping them from getting their ultimate goals, which is fascinating. I think, I was just thinking as you were saying that, because Logan's Run is a mild departure in the fact that it's not a solo, it's an ensemble chase. And I was thinking, one that does actually do this and then deviates from it and does it in a slightly different way, is if it becomes conscious that it can't sustain it, is Farscape.
Yes.
Where you have Ben Browder's John Crichton, who commits, inverted commas, a crime against Krace's brother, who's killed in an accident, and Krace starts chasing him across the universe. And it's not quite the same sort of thing, but it's that same sort of predicament that, how long can you prolong this? And you can see it in the actual stories that they're clearly feeling they can't. And then by near the end of season one, they introduce Scorpius, which creates a different element and a different tangential direction for the story to go in. But it's almost like there they used to kind of realize this model is just no longer operable by 1999. We can't do it.
Well, and you see that all the series that fell on their sword sort of with a fugitive format, even series you truly would not expect, like the Planet of the Apes TV series, where you had, two human fugitives in Roddy McDowell's Galen, and they're on the run every week and being pursued by General Urko and the apes. And again, these are people who are like, stand out like a sore thumb in this society, and even they can't be caught, it's like, really? Or they are caught and they escape. But, there's an inherent sort of dishonesty about this format because, the first episode of a fugitive type series is usually really good because it focuses on this person and what happens to them. Kimball's wife is killed, he's accused of the crime, he's arrested, he's going to be given the death penalty, but the train derails, he escapes, and the chase is on, and it's really about him.
Yeah,
it's the story is about that character. These astronauts land you know, in a future run by apes, and they realize, you know, they have to find a way back to their world, and they escape from the apes, and they're on the run. And it's really about them and their story. But then we get to, you know, episode two or three, and oh, this week we're meeting a little girl who's being abused by her father, and they have to help them. You know, it's the focus really kind of shifts to, you know, this soap opera plotting where it's like, well, we're no longer really addressing the chase or what you need to do. You know, we might genuflect to that and mention and say, well, this week we're here because we're trying to find a computer to play our magnetic disc on Planet of the Apes so that we can go back through the time warp and get back to our time. I mean, they might say something like that, but really, no, it's the story is, oh, there's this woman and her child who are hungry and starving, and the apes, you know, recruit them to, you know, to trick Verdon into thinking he has a family, you know, and it becomes, you know, this it becomes something different. And you certainly see that in the future. It's like, who are we going to help this week? Well, yeah. You know, this person who's going through this person has a horse ranch, and their horse ranch is going to be bought by this evil, corrupt guy, this bad rancher. If Dr. Richard Kimball, you know, can't help them, you know, it becomes like, okay, but wait a minute, isn't he on the run? You know, isn't he? Isn't he trying to do that thing that is going to free him? You know, isn't David Banner, why is he stopping at a disco this week and working at a disco and trying to help this young woman at a disco? And why is he not looking at what he needs to do to extricate himself from this life or death situation?
Shush, shush, says Glenn Larson. I'm writing all this down. You know, I've got shows I can wake from this. And interestingly enough, You, as you say, this the pattern, if we talk about the singular model of it being a person on the run, wrongly accused with someone following them to arrest them, it, as you say, it sort of splits off in the 70s and 80s into sort of slight variations, and they certainly start playing as what we call the sort of vague anthology of the protagonist entering a new story or maybe even a new genre sometimes each week. And their actual main story sort of being circumnavigated for a little bit. So like the A-Team is another example of this, thinking of Larson, where you have them on the run from the army, which is utterly ludicrous to the point that puts Planet of the Apes to shame, because not only are they highly distinctive, not only do they have a van with a bloody red stripe along it, which should be able to be detected in any city it enters, you've got the face who has a Corvette, which isn't in every episode, which means he must be having it moved from various places, which must be so bloody easy to track. But yeah, so but as you say, the more the model is exploited, the more the weaknesses become apparent. And I think The Fugitive only just about survives in the fact you're in a period where, you know, when you've got the sort of continent of America, there is, you know, you've only got telephone. You sort of have a certain amount of disconnect between that sort of connectivity. There's a lot of spaces where you could hide out or you could disappear off the track is the idea, isn't it? So it seems feasible-ish, even though he never changes. He never changes his hair. They never even combs it a different way. But I suppose he's meant to look ordinary in the same way that North by Northwest, that Cary Grant's Thornhill is meant to look ordinary enough that he can sort of disappear into a crowd, even though Cary Grant is possibly quite the opposite. So I think, yeah, in those situations, it becomes, I think the one which was probably the most clever in its conception is the Banner Hulk, in the idea that they kill off Banner in the first episode, so they're not looking for him. He is not someone's face they're looking for. They're looking for a nondescript average Joe with dark hair, and that's all they know. And so in that way, it feels a little more believable. Not totally believable, because he's always on foot. He's got no Corvette he can leap into to sort of move him to the next city. So there's only a certain amount of routes he could be taking. But no one totally believes in this. So he does. So you've got a journalist. So he's not got the military or the police on his side. So it's quite a clever little model set up there that gives it a certain amount of believability until the green guy appears and starts throwing the cardboard boxes about.
And I think the Hulk works really well. I mean, I really like the Hulk. I think that was a modification of the Fugitive format that worked because it had some sort of organic drive to it that maybe some of the others don't. It was something in Bill Bixby's performance. It was something in the idea of he had to sort of submerge because he was also dangerous and he was aware he was dangerous. You know, and so it's for somehow it didn't have to be this like a straight line. But some of these things, it's like, why isn't it a straight line? You know, the Phoenix, which is, you know, an ancient astronaut show. Yeah, Judson Scott playing Bennu, you know, wakes up and, you know, needs to find his partner so they can do whatever they're going to do to get off the planet or whatever. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, so find your partner. You know, you should really look for your partner. You shouldn't stop, you know, wherever you end up each week and, you know, get involved in other people's problems. You should probably just find your partner. Whereas David Banner is more like, he can't because he was sort of unsuitable to really live his life. He had to sort of live on the periphery of society. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, his interaction seemed a little more organic. I really liked the Hulk. Maybe it was because that was one of my earlier, you know, experiences with that format. But no, it seemed to make more sense.
I think it is a good show. And I think that the weakness of the show is actually the Hulk, sadly. But the... I think you're right. One of the things I have against Fugitive is I find David Jensen's Richard Kimball, he's actually, when you rewatch it, he's quite an arse. He's not particularly likable. Yeah, he's a jerk. He sort of has all these women floating around him, which he seems really annoyed with, and he treats them pretty poorly. He sulks most of the time. There's nothing really charming about him. You feel for his situation. You don't really like him. But with Bill Bixby in the Banner situation, he is actually very charming as a character, and I think that's a lot of Bixby's way. I mean, I've never knew Bill Bixby, so I don't know what he's like as a person, but certainly the person he plays on the screen, often there's a certain charm to his roles, and certainly as the Hulk, he sort of gets this lovely mediation between being a very soft and gentle character, yet at the same time there's a strength in him, which you very rarely see played in any of the other Banners that you'll see. I mean, maybe the most recent Avengers ones is a bit of it there.
Yeah.
But
no,
that gentleness is that mixture of gentleness and strength. As a man, I found very empowering because it made me think that masculinity isn't about being a Michael Knight. It's about being someone who's soft, kind, thoughtful, but knows when to stand the line and say no more. And I thought that was a really great character.
I think you're right. I mean, there was something, you know, haunted about him, but something sensitive but strong, just as you said. And you think, okay, so are we saying like it essentially comes down to like the personality of the lead actor? But in a way it does. You know, your person on the run has to be somebody that you're going to invest in and feel that you want to see. And if you don't have that, then it this format truly does become simply a matter of puzzle elements and how do they fit together, and you become very aware of the dramatic contrivances. You know, the hapless pursuer becomes much more hapless seeming, or you know, the quest seems more distant, because of course that's the other thing, is that you always have you know, this quest that the hero is on to find their cure, to find the real murderer of his wife, to find his partner. You know, there's the ending. There's that ending. I mean, I think even in the 1987 show Werewolf, which was kind of a man on the run show, there's like, who's the originator of the werewolf bloodline, and we have to kill them so that the lead character is then no longer a werewolf. You know, the quest has to still seem somewhat urgent, so you're watching it every week and you're following like the pieces of it. And if it doesn't, it just becomes like this distant, amorphous thing. Like, why am I running? Where am I running to? You know, and I think the bad examples of the Man on the Run format are the ones where you sort of lose the drive. Like, wait, why am I doing this? What's the urgency? What's the end game? I mean, I like Planet of the Apes as a franchise, and I'm reviewing the TV series on my blog now. But I mean, some episodes there's just like sort of no mythology or drive at all. It's like, well, this week we just settle down with a family of you know, ape farmers who are, you know, prejudiced against humans, and we'll help them grow some crops. Oh, and look, now here comes Urko, gotta leave. You know, and it's like, now where do we end up next week? Oh, at a fishing community. Let's teach them how to use nets instead of spear. You know, I think, okay. So really there's no real drive or urgency. What's keeping me watching? Where's the mythology aspect? And you know, I think if you don't have that, these series sort of lose their focus.
It's a funny thing, because I certainly, for the work I've been doing, research work I've been doing, you know, we talk about formats, we tend to look at sort of factual and non-scripted things. We'll look at, you know, Big Brother as a format, or, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, sort of very standardized structures to shows which can be replicated, you know, locally and globally. And yet we don't really talk too much about them. We don't seem to, certainly as just, you know, people, we don't talk about them so much in shows. And the format there is very clear that it's not a genre, it is a format. Because as you say, that format slips into science fiction, Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run.
Right.
It fits into contemporary, The Fugitive. It fits into superheroes, Incredible Hulk. You know, it's genre malleable, but the format is kind of, it's restrictive. But it's obviously clearly there to give shows a lot of flexibility. That, as you say, you go to new places each week where you can place stories or genre story. I don't know if they're genre stories, but they're stories that audiences can identify with. And thus you create, you know, an easy, fast, I don't want to say fast buck show, but a safe show. A show that's been tried and tested with a slight tweak to it, slight freshness. But they know that they're going to sort of... And it is true, you do end up in, you know, The Incredible Hulk. You've seen this all before in a million shows, but because you like Banner, because of the situation that starts to be crafted within that show, even if you see the familiarities in it, helping the blind person, or he is the blind person, or helping the mother in need, or helping the, you know... It works, and they know it works, and it comes down to, as you say, the chemistry the audience has with the main character or characters. If they have that chemistry, they will follow that character through the same story again. And I think that's part and parcel of it. How long can you keep that chemistry with that main character? How long can you keep that marriage going effectively?
Exactly. And, you know, because you do have this very fixed format. And, you know, today, I mean, if we were to say, okay, we're bringing, we're going to bring Spider-Man to television, and what's going to happen is in the first episode, J. Jonah Jameson is going to run him out of town. And each week, Spider-Man will be in a different town, hiding out, only occasionally turning into, you know, putting on the costume. Peter Parker will be, you know, just helping people in, you know, different towns that he ends up. You know, fans would quite rightly say, well, you know, this is a swindle. what is this? Right? What are you doing? This, you know, you're creating a sort of non-mythology world, but you're creating like a mainstream world. And then I guess when I say soap opera, that's sort of what I'm thinking about. You know, what in the, you know, in some sense, it comes down to like, how do we understand what TV producers thought audiences wanted out of science fiction in the 60s or 70s or 80s. What was their understanding of it? And, you know, it seems to be like, well, okay, we're going to have these ingredients. It will be in the future. It will be in a post-apocalypse. It will be with talking apes. But, you know, that's going to be too esoteric for, you know, mainstream audiences to approve of and like. So we have to do something very basic where all of the stories are sort of these soap opera stories about the blind person. And there's even that story in the Planet of the Apes where they meet a blind ape, a young chimpanzee female who falls in love with Burke. And of course, he's human and she can't be in love with a human. You know, you can go across these Man on the Run stories and it's like the same story. You know, we get the same story, but they're not really genre stories. What they are, they're, you know, platitudes that are parables that we're already familiar with. And they're saying, okay, we know you don't like science fiction. Science fiction is kids' stuff, but it's okay because we're going to tell you stories that you're sort of familiar with already.
I wonder if some of that was to do with, I mean, I think what's fascinating here, first of all, is that I think maybe the Fugitive format is probably the most rigid fictional format I can think of at this moment in time. You have a definitive beginning. You have a very definitive end. You can't really go past without it collapsing. So you have a very structured situation. But I was wondering whether this is an industry sort of thing. Because, I mean, a lot of times you'd have writers who are signed on, who worked specifically for specific studios. And, you know, was it so much of a fact that, you know, these are writers that were moving genres and would essentially just bring their bag of tricks. And those generic bag of tricks would therefore sort of see whether they could fit them around some of these different shows, especially these more sort of wacky, sort of high concept shows, maybe, like, you know, Planet of the Apes. And maybe there they have to think, wow, could I use the blind thing here really well? Because the blind thing with the ape and the human, that's just awesome, you know. And I wonder if that's part and parcel of why you get this sort of, why it becomes such a popular No, it's not a popular. Why it becomes so common? Is this the bag of tricks that the writers of the period have, and they are just bringing it to whatever genre they're assigned to do, rather than being skilled within those genres, if you see what I mean? Which is what we tend to have a little more of these days.
I think so. I think that what you say is absolutely right, is that, you know, these writers were, you know, shopping, you know, carrying their luggage from one series that was on the air to the other. They probably got a job on a series because they did an episode somebody liked of another series. So, you know, the people who produced Logan's Run, I mean, let's, you know, be absolutely fair. They were the people who produced Charlie's Angels. And I'm not trying to put down Charlie's Angels or anything like that, but it's like, okay, yeah, it's like I look at Charlie's Angels, like, you're the right one to do Logan's Run. No, I don't really get that. No, they were capable of putting a show together, but were they really understanding science fiction, or were they just someone who was capable of putting a successful series together? And that's where they were brought on. They brought on some writers from Charlie's Angels, but they were also smart enough to bring on, you know, Dorothy Fontana, DC Fontana. So it's like, okay, yeah, okay. So you knew to hire the right people sometimes, and then maybe sometimes not the right people. You know, it's just very interesting. But I think you're right. I think it was more a function of the industry than saying, okay, these are people we know. They'll turn in a story on time. And look, they did this story on Charlie's Angels. Why can't they write a Logan's Run?
And maybe the other factor then, therefore, is not just the writers, but within the cost effectiveness of the industry, in the sense that these stories, these classic molded stories, were ones that required a limited principal cast, because they would sort of, as you say, have a melodrama element which was focused around a few central characters. You'd have one key principal cast who would be in each episode or so, and the rest would be guest stars. So you've got that sort of effectiveness in costs. You've got the fact that these sort of general areas were already created round Hollywood, or places they could use around California. So
right.
Their trips around the world, the universe, the future, all sort of settled around a sort of slightly arid wander around Vasquez Rocks or wherever.
Right.
You know, so I wonder whether these sort of things also sort of came together. And I don't know really what we're saying here, because it's sort of whether that is why The Fugitive proved to be... Did The Fugitive create something as a long serial which proved could be therefore transferable to other stories or other shows that the industry could create, be it through its writing and through its infrastructure? I don't know.
I think so, and I think that, you know, we come from the vantage point of 21st century TV. Now we've grown up with TV. You know, we know, you know, how these stories work, you know, in and out. And you know, you have to realize, again, you go back to the early 60s when TV was new. People didn't have, and I'm not trying to say they were stupid, but they just didn't have that kind of understanding.
Absolutely.
Of serialized TV. And so they weren't thinking every week, oh, I'm not going to see this story resolve, or, you know, this is just a blind alley. You know, we're just going to get another melodrama until this show ends. They're thinking, oh, what's going to happen to Kimball this week? It was a different kind of, just like, I suppose, because I wasn't there. I mean, you look at a show like Gilligan's Island and you say, well, they're, you know, all the tension this week is about, are we going to get rescued? But, you know, think about what TV is. No, you can't get rescued because then the show is over. You know, the Fugitive is a format like that. It's like a Gilligan's Island format. It's like, you know, it can't resolve unless the show is canceled. But if the show is canceled, it's not going to be resolved because they're not going to shoot a closing episode because it wasn't popular enough to merit that. You know, it's this weird sort of catch-22. I think, you know, it's a format that TV has very wisely outgrown. You know, and I find it incredibly frustrating, although in the 80s, I mean, I watched The Phoenix. I watched Starman. You know, even, God forbid, Galactica 1980 had this sort of characteristic with Troy and Dylan on the run on Earth and
yeah.
Colonel Siddell, you know, played by Alan Miller, you know, trying to track them down. Werewolf had it as late as 87. The Visitor was on Fox in the mid-90s when The X-Files was, and that was like about an alien on Earth who was going through the steps of a fugitive format. You know,
Dark Skies in the 90s as well was a similar role,
right,
as I recall.
Right, and they were smart enough, the producers of Dark Skies, they started the beginning of the season where you know, John Lowengard and what's her name, Kim Sayers, they were on the run.
Yeah.
They fled Washington. They were on the run. By mid-season, like the government was like had found them and was calling them back to be, you know, basically then like secret agents, because I guess they realized this whole, you know, man on the run format you just can't do anymore. You can, maybe, you know, I guess that was what, 96, close to Farscape. You know, that I think that was the point where people were realizing that, you know, people see what this is and it's a swindle. We set up this fantastic situation, like somebody set up for murder, and you know, they're framed and their life is at stake, and that's the first episode, and then you don't hear anything about that, you know, for a couple of years. You know, or we'll give you one episode a year where you might see the one-armed man, but that's it. You know, there is this sort of feeling that we're selling you one thing but you're getting something else.
It's interesting that selling and trying to give something else. I mean, I remember Monk, which was, you know, the 2000s, the procedural cop drama. It had that similar sort of issue, but not as a fugitive scenario, but it set up in its opening episode who killed his wife, and they had that same issue of it being a procedural whodunit each week sort of thing, but occasionally they'd have to sort of address the fact that people were still interested in who killed his wife, and you've got automatically that burden which sits with the show. As soon as you sort of suggest an ending at the beginning, which some, as you say, some formats automatically do, it locks you into a situation automatically. And how do you, and I mean, suppose in a totally different format, Battlestar Galactica had exactly the same issue. They were off to find Earth. That was on the front of every title card, you know, at the beginning of this stories, on their quest to find Earth. What do you do when they find Earth? You should close the show. So you get locked in again into the same. But I think it's interesting when you saw about the 60s and we're saying that, you know, we're not saying that writers were bad. It was just that television was new. And I think that's really true. I remember reading a fantastic book on Mission Impossible and the amount of burnout they had on writers on that show, because it was just so difficult for writers to write for. Because you couldn't do the blind person. You couldn't do the woman in trouble. It was a totally different scripted format function. And they would just burn out season per season. Now, I think if you did that show now, and there are shows that have been like that, and I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know there have been, you would not have that sort of burnout rate, because people are now more understanding of television. They understand the components more. I think you'd carry on without that issue, as you say, just because there's purely more experience to fall back on.
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, you they tried to redo The Fugitive a couple years ago, and it failed after a couple episodes. And I think you can't really do the show in the way it was designed to be done anymore, because you're raising too many questions every week. Like, well, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? Why have you chosen to go here? Why are you stopping your quest to do this? Why isn't the person who's hunting you doing A, B, and C? You know, we're just a lot more, I don't want to say jaded, but we're just maybe a lot more knowledgeable about sort of like, you know, how those situations work and what would you do in a situation like that? You know, and it's not going to be, well, I'm on the run, someone's trying to kill me, so I'm going to stop here and help this single mother in jeopardy deal with, you know, the bully landlord upstairs. You know, that's, you know, I mean, that's terrible if that's going on. But it's like, you know, that doesn't really apply to me. You know, I need to go do what I'm going to do to, you know, clear my name. I need to be working on that. And, you know, there's no sort of knowledge of that or awareness in The Fugitive of that. And, you know, the format certainly reached, you know, ludicrous heights, James, with the show that I introduced you to, so I know you want to talk about.
This is a brilliant show. It's stunning. Go on, please explain it to them. They might remember it.
This was a 1970s Saturday morning live action TV show that used The Fugitive as its model, and it was called Run, Joe, Run. And the man on the run was not a man. He was a canine. He was a German Shepherd. It was a German Shepherd who was accused, I guess, of biting his trainer, who then was going to be put to sleep by the military. He was a Marine dog, I guess. And instead of being put to sleep, he managed to escape and go on the run. And a bounty hunter would chase him each week, trying to bring this dog to justice. And meanwhile, Joe would interact every week with, you know, different families or people who needed his help. And I understand you actually watched an episode recently.
Yes, I did. They are out there. It is... I mean, the title sequence is fascinating because it's actually quite hard to discern. It looks like if you watch the title sequence, to me, it looked like he did bite the owner. And it's another dog. The whole idea is that he witnesses another dog biting. And then he is accused and he has to run. And his owner doesn't believe that he was the one who bit. It's a weird... But the thing is, it looks in the title, if you watch it and you get it wrong, that he does actually bite it and then pegs it. And they're chasing him for the whole... Which probably would be a more interesting... format, but it is very interesting. And you get in the 70s and a little later on you get The Littlest Hobo, which does a sort of a simplified version thereof, of a dog doing a sort of lassie, I guess, really, isn't it? It's wandering the country, helping people out, but it doesn't have that it doesn't have that literal fugitive format to it, which is, I think, was just so funny about Run Joe Run, is it is just transposing those main initial concepts of the fugitive onto a dog,
right.
And then have the dog having to run. I mean, I suppose one of the arguments for it is there's probably more chance of a dog escaping than a human, because, you know, people, dogs look the same to a lot of they
could. Right.
But you really enjoyed this. I mean, do you want to say a little more about this? I mean, as I say, people can probably find a couple of episodes. You certainly can see the opening sequence, which we will probably put on the show notes. I'll get Christian to put on the show notes.
For me, I mean, this aired in – Run, Joe, Run aired in 1975, 1976. I was 5, 6 years old. I was, you know, watching things like this on Saturday mornings, Land of the Lost, Isis, Shazam. And Run, Joe, Run was a piece of that equation. And it ran for 2 seasons, which is actually pretty good for a Saturday morning TV show. You know, many ran just 1 season, like, you know, the Ghostbusters or Monster Squad or what have you. So, you know, it was fascinating. This was a presence, you know, for a time in my young life. And I remembered it fondly, but it has never had a DVD or VHS release. So it has remained for me one of those sort of mist and shrouded memories from youth. You know, so what I always say is, you know, is it a lost treasure or merely lost? You know, and I think I have not watched the episode. I always check to see if there are episodes on there. Last time I checked, there were just the opening montages. You know, I suspect, because what I tend to find is that it's merely lost. It's not a lost treasure. But, you know, certainly at that time in my life, that was my first exposure to the fugitive format. So then when I got to later shows like, you know, The Hulk or The Phoenix or Starman or tried to catch up with the Immortal or what have you, it was like, okay, so this is just Run, Joe, Run all over again. You know, right? But of course, Run, Joe, Run was copying. It was derivative. It was not originating.
Yes. Yeah, it was again, it's one of those beautiful elevator pitches, isn't it? It's Lassie meets Fugitive.
Right. I'm talking about high concept, right?
Yeah, that's... I know. Can't get any simpler, can you? That is essentially what they sold, which must have made that the simplest pitch meeting ever. But yeah, so they ran this. It was 25 episodes or so, I think. He says, yeah. Trying to check.
2 seasons?
26 episodes. 26 episodes. I think there was a slight change for the second season, which often comes when they try and move things along. But essentially, yeah, it's just very interesting to see, again, this mixture of the fugitive genre being moved into the sort of kids, lassie sort of approach. Like I say, I mean, I remember a more derivative version of The Littlest Hobo, which was a few years later, which doesn't have those concepts of the fugitive in there, that the dog is not on the run. The dog is just like a drifter, which, again, I suppose is like saying we're meeting Lassie meets the fugitive meets... The drifter genre, I suppose, you know. It's a 3-point throwing them in together. Because in the end, the stories were very much like The Fugitive, very much like Run, Joe, Run, very much like all the things we're talking about, where it was just the standard net, you know, meeting people, dealing with their problems, and then leaving by the end of the episode for whatever reason.
it's really amazing. I mean, you think about it. So The Fugitive was ported over to Saturday Morning for Kids with a dog, okay? It was brought into the superhero milieu with the Hulk. It was brought into, you know, ancient astronaut science fiction with some of the shows we talked about. Were some of the ones we talked about there? Oh, The Immortal, Starman, The Phoenix. It was brought into horror with Werewolf in the 80s. It was even in the 90s, there was a really fascinating conspiracy show called Nowhere Man, which had aspects of The Fugitive. It was sort of a blend of The X-Files and The Fugitive. And I mean, I think that's actually a pretty good show, because I think they had the sense in that episode. This was about a man named Thomas Vale who took a picture that some shadowy group didn't want him to take that photograph, and they like erased his life, and he sort of had to – they even erased like his wife. I mean, his wife was still there, but she like couldn't acknowledge him. It was, I think it was Megan Gallagher from Millennium, I think. I could be wrong. Oh my gosh, I'm not sure. But so someone will have to check me on that. But then like each week he would like try to figure out he would like track back the mystery of that photo. Who was in that photo? What was going on? And then this show only lasted one season, but it did have a discrete end where they solved the whole thing. So that was maybe a I get, and you know, it's funny, you can't say it was a more successful version of The Fugitive because it lasted one season, but to me it was kind of successful because it actually stuck to its story and told its whole story and then ended, as opposed to something like The Phoenix or Starman, which never has any kind of ending and just, you know, rambled off into these stories about single mother in jeopardy, a horse who's going to be put down and they have to save, or what, you know, whatever the stock story is of the week.
Do you think part of the interest is in one genre we've not talked about yet here, because it doesn't really totally apply, but maybe some of the sort of evocativeness of it exists in is the road trip, in the sense that you are going from place to place. This is a sense of freedom, of the escapism, of the frontier. The same thing that I suppose Star Trek has for people, you know, this idea of going to different places, meeting new people. And there's a sort of is that part of what makes the sort of Fugitive format sort of vaguely interesting, that you're passing through different people's lives, which gives you as the audience a feeling of a broader world out there, even if the world is made of very similar stories you've seen the other week on the Dukes of Hazzard.
You know, that's a great point. I was thinking, you know, even Star Trek had in its opening a sort of suggestion of an end. You know, this is a 5-year mission, yeah. Of course. Now we've gotten, you know, 50 years. But, yeah, so it's like – so I guess, yeah, it's like in these 5 years, you're going to see all these different things. But there wasn't – you know, they weren't being chased.
No, absolutely not. But there were – but what I'm saying is that, I mean, ignoring that 5-year, there was that sort of what drove people in that, I think, a lot of the time was the feeling of that frontier that you could go and meet – all these new people. I'm not saying it's similar in any way, because you're doing it in these fugitive genres. These fugitive formats normally exist within a world that you understand. Not always, but certainly The Fugitive did. You were going around America, which Americans would sort of be able to identify with. So Star Trek, you're going to places you don't quite identify with, but you do sort of, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to invest in them. But there is that sort of feeling of travel, I think is what I'm saying, is that in all these sort of things, audiences sit down and they enjoy that feeling of travel, that they're not just sitting in a town, like, say, Dukes of Hazzard, that you're actually – and they'd be upset if they watch Dukes of Hazzard and they go outside the town. They like it being there. But in this sort of format, they want to see these different places, even though they're very similar. Or do they? I think that's something I've always liked about it. I don't know whether other people like about it.
You know, that's another really great point. And I think in some sense it goes back to the 60s and what people were seeing. So, you know, suddenly like everybody is starting to have a TV, and then we're getting color TV, and it's like, wow, we have the opportunity to go everywhere now. And people who, you know, are living in, say, you know, middle America are not going to be traveling to all these places. So there is this opportunity to live vicariously and see all these places that you're not going to see otherwise, for sure. I mean, you know, you talk about the James Bond films and the travelogue component in the 60s. It's like, okay, where is it set this time? I'm not only seeing, you know, this story and experiencing this adventure, but I'm also experiencing the sense of place. They went here and, you know, jumped off a bridge or whatever, or flipped a car over a bridge in, you know, Thailand or whatever. You know, but I'm seeing some taste of that location, some sense of that location. And so in The Fugitive, yeah, I guess that's true. It's like, okay, well, I can visit a cattle ranch. I've never been to a cattle ranch before, but now look, I'm gonna be in a disco. Or, you know, it's like,
but does it go
a big city disco?
Does it go more than that? Does it go one step further? And this again applies really more to the very purest fugitive format. Is it about the absolute freedom, the relinquishing of material, of burden of ownership, that you are in these sort of situations literally moving from one place, enjoying it, and then you're sodding off to the next place? And I say enjoying it, the character isn't, but you as the audience are, and right. Then you are sort of that freedom, even though you're being hunted in lots of these cases, you have the freedom that you're being hunted, but you have nothing to hold you down. And I suppose if you're living in a 9-to-5 job, you've got a family you love, you know you're creating a man cave for your son or whatever, you know, you're looking at these shows and seeing someone who has none of that. They are just literally going, is it the ultimate man quest? Because, you know, they're also bedding women as often, or getting the interest of women, but they don't have to have any responsibility to them because they've got a problem. And their problem's so big that they can't hang around, love. Sorry. I love you and everything. You're very exciting, but I've got to be on, you know. It's that,
right.
And so they get to escape to the next adventure on this very man dramatic excuse that they've got the biggest problem in the world to deal with, that they can't deal with. Your problems that they're dealing with each week are infinitesimal compared to their ones, because they turn bloody green every night, or, you know, they've got the Justice Department hunting them down. They can't stay around. In some ways, you look at it like that, it's the ultimate masculine show. It's the ultimate masculine dream in a lot of ways, because they never look dirty. They always have a little bit of money.
Right.
Even Banner, how Banner manages to keep that same bloody leather bag, it's the same one. He doesn't never loses it. Or he always goes and buys an identical one.
That is a brilliant point. I mean, you know, when people ask me, you know, why is The Walking Dead so successful, you know, I say, well, it's not the zombies, it's wish fulfillment, because it's like you're living.
Yes.
You know, all the difficult things, like, can I pay my credit card this month? I have college loans. I need a new car. I got to go to my job. You know, all that's gone. Yeah, you got to deal with zombies, but that's a different set of problems. There's this wish fulfillment aspect of television, and that's really what you're talking about there. And it also plays in, I think, as well, as to why the format aged. You know, in terms of like seeing a new place every week, it's like, wow, I'm going here this week. But part of the problem is if you watch The Immortal or The Phoenix or Starman, it's like after a while, it's like you've been to every, you know, ranch in Southern California. You've been, you know, you've been to Vasquez Rock 6 times. Like, there is a sameness about it after a while that The Fugitive didn't have, but the other ones did. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, I recognize that rock from Logan's Run. It was also in Planet of the Apes, you know. It's like, oh my gosh, right? You know, that's a bad situation. And in some sense, that diminishes the whole like, I want to go see new places, I want to go have those adventures. Like, well, yeah, I've seen that already, we've done that. So like, the older the format goes, it actually like ages and locates itself out of wish fulfillment. It becomes less fulfilling.
Yeah, less fulfilling, yes. But it's interesting then, again, as you say, you have a reinvigoration of that. And I totally agree with you. I mean, I watch Z Nation. I don't really watch The Walking Dead, but I enjoyed Z Nation. I'm still waiting for season 2 over here on Netflix in the UK.
Okay.
But there is something slightly freeing in the post-apocalyptic genre. Because,
absolutely,
again, all these pressures, which perhaps are now perhaps even more so on us because we're so much more hooked into technology, you know, social media, we're so much more governed by image of what we should be doing. I mean, I was thinking the other night, you know, when I'm on my deathbed, I'm going to sit there with regrets, not because I'll have done anything inherently wrong. It's just because I'll have known that there's so many things I inherently could have done. There's so many paths that you can have now, which, you know, 100 years ago.
But you were doing a podcast.
Well, that's it. I was doing a podcast. I could be out there on a beach, or, you know, or I could have sorted out my life in a way, and I could have been flying around, or I could have been a person who worked on a farm and enjoyed that, or I could have been someone who worked in the city. There's so many avenues that are now available to us as first world country citizens that, you know, you're going to go to your deathbed thinking, what if I'd done something different? Not because you've done anything wrong, but because now you can do so many things. Those potential avenues are all there. You've got to pick one. But that means when you pick one, you don't pick the others. And I'm sorry if this depresses people listening to it, but it is bloody well depressing me this weekend. You will have those regrets. And so I suppose the post-apocalyptic scenario cleans the floor, you know, wipes the floor. There's no choices apart from survival. And suddenly, I think, a bit like The Fugitive, that seems quite exciting.
Right. No, you have an excellent point. I mean, you know, it's crazy, but, you know, you look at The Walking Dead or Z Nation, you think, you can't help but think, not only are there, you know, it's like you're being faced with these survival things, but also like, well, I guess that solves global warming because we're not going to be putting all these emissions into the atmosphere. You know, I guess that solves overpopulation. You know, and I didn't have to lift a finger, right?
No, Christmas becomes so much easier. The stress of Christmas. Right,
exactly. I mean, it's crazy, but it isn't crazy. You know what I mean? It sounds crazy, but it actually makes a lot of sense to think that way. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think television entertainment, a lot of it is wish fulfillment and, you know, functions on that level. I mean, certainly Star Trek, you know, it's like saying, okay, there's this frontier out there again. There are places that haven't been explored. There are new things to encounter. You know, just as the Westerns, like, okay, we're going to take you back to what it was like to be a cowboy when not everything was so programmed. You didn't have your 9-to-5 job like this. You know, you weren't governed like this. You know, you can pick any genre and sort of say there's a wish fulfillment aspect to it. So it certainly has to be with The Fugitive. And, you know, I like what you're saying. You know, there's a very masculine you know, sorry, don't call me, I'll call you, you know, next time I get to a phone, but it might be 2 months from now, you know.
And it's justified as well, you know. It's not like as every man would love to have, you know, they'd feel a bit of a dick, you know, leaving, unless they had a good justification, like, you know, I've got this massive crippling medical issue, which means I can't hang around, or I've got the Justice Department, sorry, you know, it's not me being a dick, it's the fact that I've just got to go. And that's, you know, the ultimate masculine wish fulfillment, you know. The old kids in the hall line, isn't it? You know, I just want to be alone with you tonight, but I don't want to be with you tomorrow morning, if you get what I'm saying. It's that sort of line he has. I can't remember exactly, it's paraphrased, but that sort of utter masculine truth that I want this now, but I don't want to deal with it later. I don't want to deal with the repercussions. I want to keep moving like a child onto my next. And these are very childlike scenarios, as you say. I mean, apart from The Fugitive, I mean, one of the reasons I think as you said quite right, the reason this has died out as a genre is it's become harder to do so far, is that the world has become so much more intercommunicated. I remember watching a few years ago, John Sim did a show in the UK called Prey. And then they did a second season, oddly, with Philip Glenstow, who was also in Life on Mars as well. John Sim being most famous probably for Life on Mars and Doctor Who. But it was only 6 episodes, as I recall, but it was exactly the same Fugitive format. Someone wrongly accused on the run in Britain. And it was like, how can you do that these days? Is it easy? There was even a non-scripted show where there was a guy who, I believe, I don't know if you've heard of this, who actually said, he actually got agencies having to try and track him down. He went on the run and he wanted to see how long he could stay on the run before they actually found him.
Wow.
And, you know, how can you do it in this age? Because you've got not just telegrams and the phone. You've got, you know, you've got credit cards. You've got, you know, GPS mapping. You've got satellites overhead. You've got cameras on every street corner.
Right. Everybody has a pocket camera. Yeah. You know, it's just much harder to do now and to do it in a way that, you know, is it all believable?
Exactly.
I guess you could always set it in the 60s, you know, like Mad Men.
That would be the way, yes.
You know, you could always go do set it back in that time. But I think that, too, I just think that in some sense we've outgrown the format like that. You know, someone needs to sort of rethink the format, you know, to rethink what The Fugitive means or how to do it. And, you know, really, you know, sit down. Somebody like, you know, I think about Veronica Mars, which was a show I loved, and it was sort of a noir detective show, but incorporating all the latest technology. So it's like it's updating this really old, you know, detective sort of private dick formula, but at the same time, it's telling those like old stories of corruption and vice and class differences. It's using, you know, iPhones and laptops and, you know, computer virus. You know, it's incorporating all that so that it all feels fresh again. Somebody would need to look at sort of what the essence is of The Fugitive and like, how do you do that now? How can you do that now? How can you update this now in a way that people will buy it and sort of be invigorated by it?
I think it's a hard one, and I think that the essence of it was in, as we've said, the post-apocalyptic, where you can have a situation where you remove the entirety of the telecommunications issues, you carry the same freedom of the masculinity freedom again is put to the forefront, where, you know, you don't have really any belongings, you're surviving day by day, you have to keep moving on. I was thinking back to Falling Skies and just watching that, which is not zombie apocalypse, it's obviously alien post-apocalypse. I remember getting slight feelings of watching things like The Incredible Hulk and The Fugitives in the second season of that, when they're on the road stopping and just as a convoy trying to get they had a goal at the end of for the end of the season, so it was 13 episodes, so it was manageable. But those sort of feelings were there, of that sort of freedom of them meeting new people, but they weren't able to sit back into those formats that we've talked about, those predictable formats. Right. They did occasionally, I think. They did actually find a couple of people living in the sticks. But even there, they weren't. They were done in that sort of post-apocalyptic narrative and discourses. So it was slightly different. But I think that was what replaced it for those reasons, and to give those same sort of feelings of that sort of masculinity freedom, which I think The Fugitive gave, and the A-Team gave, you know, which isn't The Fugitive, but I think they all carry that same sort of thing, where it's men often on the run, where they can encounter different places, different worlds, but then they have to move on. I'm not quite sure what Michael Knight's excuse was, but somehow he had the same setup.
You know, in the 80s too, it's interesting that I think, you know, some of these programs began to undercut maybe that wish fulfillment, and that's why they didn't succeed. I'm thinking, you know, we talked about Logan's Run, he brings along Jessica and Rem, so he's got like a chaperone and a girlfriend with him, so immediately you're not going to have a lot of romantic stories because people are going to see that as a violation of his relationship with Jessica. And in Starman, he's traveling with his son, you know, and that also, you know, puts some stops on the rampant masculinity. You know, it's like, it's not so much wish fulfillment, I guess, if, you know, you're bringing an entourage with you. And, you know, it's like, someone will call you on it if you act badly, you know, right? If you don't treat somebody well, or, you know, honestly, or what have you. I don't know. Maybe it becomes less wish fulfillment.
Well, the wish fulfillment becomes caught with real life issues. It's something you've got to negotiate, haven't you? The fact that, as you say, there's a son there. How do I make this perfect wish fulfillment work? My bloody son's watching.
Exactly. You know,
he's going to be judging me. He's not there at all. He doesn't exist. Therefore, we got rid of it. You know, it's that sort of thing. And it's interesting. I think the road trip is a key area, because when it started to mutate, you say in the 80s, especially with Glenn Larson adopting a lot of, as we said, these sort of elements that keyed up within this format, but not exclusively sitting within the rigidity of the format, with things like the A-Team and Knight Rider. Like with Knight Rider and with the A-Team as well, I think that sort of road trip factor to it, that freedom, that masculine freedom, was key to it. And yet when you see shows that spawned off Knight Rider and they got it wrong, like Street Hawk, where they had them where they had him based actually in a city, because they had a place where they would have their computers and stuff, and then they would go and take Street Hawk out to go and do various things, it became constrictive. I remember as a kid feeling, this is constrictive. I want to see him going from place to place. I want that road
freedom.
Trip. I want that freedom. So, I mean, I don't know whether that's because that's part of the motor genre. I don't think it is. I think, because Knight Rider, even though it was about the car, I think Hasselhoff especially was very keen on making it about the Hasselhoff. And, you know, the car sort of would be pushed aside often. And then you go back into these standard formats, as we talked about, these story formats, that the car being there or not was negotiable. You know, the blind person, the mother in peril, the tycoon taking over the village, the town, you know, all those sort of things. and it go back to those settlements. So yeah, it's a fascinating thing, the fugitive there. I didn't realize it was so fascinating before we started talking about it, and how much it branches off into, as you say, various other genres and story types.
I think, you know, when television, I guess, was in its infancy, the people creating it must have been thinking, how do we sustain a story over multiple weeks, over multiple years? You know, and they're not thinking novels like they build on each other. They're thinking, you know, we have to tell a complete story each week. How do we do that? What do we do? And, you know, to me, the format of The Fugitive arises from sort of that not knowing, like, of what you can do with TV, like of how far you can push people, like how you can engage people. And instead just thinking, well, we just need, you know, we're going to do this week, and then the next week we'll go here, and then the next week we'll go here. You know, I just don't think it would fly today, you know, for so many of the reasons we've talked about. But, you know, I have to admit, I hadn't really thought before you brought it up of this whole idea of the wish fulfillment and maybe how potent a thing that is, especially the masculine aspect of it. And I mean, let's not delude ourselves talking about, you know, TV in the 60s is that was,
yeah,
you know, that it was a male dominated industry, and you know, they were probably making these shows for men, right?
So yeah, there's no doubt about that. It was a male dominated right. audience. The men statistically in their homes
right.
had the remote control.
Right. So what do I want to watch?
Exactly. So, you know, what do I want to watch? And you're going to watch it with me. That was largely the way it went. And, you know, it sounds crazy, but that is the way it was. And it has shifted, obviously. But even in the 80s, you could see that was very predominant in the culture that TV was addressing. That was the male, was the man of the house. I think you're right. I think it is fascinating. I think what is kind of funny is, in a weird way, it is the perfect format if the industry was perfect, in the sense that you could lock down your final episode at any time. You get into 13 episodes, you get to mid-season, your season's not going well. You know, you have your end episode doesn't need build-up. It can occur any time because the episodes in between are, in this basic purist format, not so much now as it would be done on Netflix, largely totally episodical, that you could, the idea was, especially when syndication became a big thing, that you could have them in any order and it wouldn't make any difference whatsoever. So you have your pilot, you have your ending, and then anything in the middle can be sort of in any order whatsoever. So in theory, providing you have your end episode planned out in a perfect industry, it is a brilliant format. You can go for one season, two seasons, three seasons, and then as soon as it starts dipping in the ratings, you fire out your finale. But the industry doesn't work like that. And as soon as it starts to dip, you just cancel. You don't you don't have the time, the money, or that ability to sort of construct your episode. Or often you don't. Sometimes if you're lucky. But
I'm trying to... James, do you know of any show other than The Fugitive that actually did resolve? Or any... I'm trying to think. I know, you know, Phoenix and Starman did not. Werewolf had sort of a false ending where he killed who he thought was the progenitor of the werewolf line, only to find that it was somebody else. So, I mean, they were addressing it, but it wasn't like a definitive end.
I mean,
can you think of any?
Not really. I mean, there's ones which conveniently make endings, and I think we're going to talk about the Hulk in another week, but the Death of the Incredible Hulk does give a sort of ending to the show, to the even though the actual show itself had been cancelled, which negates
right.
as an example. But even then, he was still planning. Bixby was planning on doing another if he hadn't passed away. So, to be honest, I can't. I mean, even in ones which shared it a little bit, like if we go to say Alias Smith and Jones, they never got totally acquitted, did they?
No.
That fell apart. After a season, after one of the principals died, didn't it? The questionable suicide or whatever it was, and they recast. I can't think of any that really did. I think the one that sort of did in a funny sort of way, which again isn't totally strict to the Fugitive model, is the A-Team, where you get to, I think it's their fourth season, where they actually become part of the
That's right.
become part of the government. So you could
Robert Vaughn,
right? With Robert Vaughn, and and they're rather as Glasson always did in his fourth season when things were dropping, produce the ethnic card in there, the ethnicity card, because clearly it's the ethnicity vote that's not watching his show, and so he brings in a Mexican character, I think it is, for that fourth season as well, and he brings in the black urban character for Knight Rider, terrible stereotypes, but yes, yeah, absolutely. So they start working for Robert Vaughn, which was the kiss of death for the show, because
it ended
the Fugitive format, and but arguably in a weird way, you could argue that the first episode of season four, whatever it is the end of the A-Team, or you know, you could sort of go, right, that's it, they're now collaborators with the but I suppose they're still not quite, aren't they? I think it's still, if they don't work for them, they will be tried. I can't remember their agreement.
Yeah.
But no, I can't think of any that actually did probably have a finale apart from The Fugitive.
And see, that's so strange, because to me that is really the idea of you make a promise in a format like that. You know, and it, to me that's just like a blatant, blatant way of sort of violating your promise. You know, it's like you're going to find sanctuary. You know, you're going to, if you stay with us, you're going to be acquitted, or you're going to find a cure, or you're going to. And it's like, no, you know what? This just didn't work out. Sorry, I know some of you, 30% of the audience, you stuck with us for those 13 episodes, but you don't get anything out of this. You know, it's like, oh man, I'm trying to think of another format that's so sort of like blatantly, like, you know, screws you over at the end if it doesn't end well. You know, it's like, no, I guess that guy's just searching forever.
Yeah.
You know? That's it.
And that's the funny thing, isn't it? Because, you know, with Star Trek, 5-year mission, if you never see the end of the 5 years, you just think of them going off into the sunset and, you know, the proverbial Western sunset, riding on till sunset. Yeah, but when you actually stipulate the, I suppose in the end, because what you're arguing is that the pilot isn't the pilot. The pilot is the entire series, because it's the entire story. You don't get the final act of the pilot. The final act of the pilot is prolonged through 2 to 3 seasons. And then you don't get the end, because that's essentially all you're doing. The bits in between are fairly inconsequential. Same even with things like Battlestar Galactica. The end of the pilot, they sort of say, we're going to find Earth. You could quite easily do, like Battlestar Galactica 1980, suddenly they're at Earth. You know, they've done the trek, in between, they're now at Earth. And, you know, there's different people there. You say, well, yeah, it was a long trip, not all of them survived. But you'd have your, you know, you don't need the 4 seasons, in technically speaking. You know, the pilot is just missing that final coda to some degree. So yeah, it is, and it's the sad thing is, it is just the nature of the industry and commerce and commercial ventures. But it should be very easy to finish these stories, and as you say, there is a moral imperative there. You don't rip out the last couple of pages of the book because it's not going to sell very well. So, you know, it's frustrating that you don't have that with television. You don't have that mandate to at least give some sort of resolution. But then you've got production studios which don't want to do that, in case there is a chance, last-minute chance, that they could get another season.
Yeah, that's it. I guess sometimes, you know, they don't know they're canceled until it's too late. And like, well, we already, you know, we're done. We don't have any money left. We're not going to do it. But, you know, it's funny. Planet of the Apes, you know, the TV series got stripped down, you know, to be like, they jammed 2 episodes together. So these are going to be movies that we play in syndication. And they had Roddy McDowall come back.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and so he did provide some closure. I mean, some years later, I guess, after the Planet of the Apes series, it's like, oh yes, they found their computer disk and they plotted their trajectory and you know, they went home and, you know, here I am. It's like, okay, well, at least that, you know, belatedly there was some closure there. But of course, I've always wanted to ask, how did they build a spaceship, a functioning spaceship on the Planet of the Apes that, you know, sent them back in time? But still, hey, at least we found out Verdon and Burke made it home. But so there was an example.
I mean, this is again another podcast on you know, endings. I mean, there's some fascinating ones where you get that sort of almost not necessarily retrospective, but retrospective information, like the cartoon series Dungeons and Dragons, which got cancelled just before they started production on their final episode. So the script existed, but the episode never got made. But now the script has surfaced, and there's been people who've done YouTube videos with doing their own artwork for it, and there's been, I think there was with one of the DVDs, a fan car audio cast with a couple of the original actors creating that final episode. And you do get those moments where those final moments do exist. I mean, we've got probably the most biggest example, the most fantastic example of how television has changed to allow this sort of thing to happen with Twin Peaks.
Right.
I mean, it's insane.
I'll see you in 25 years, right? Isn't that what he said?
Yeah, absolutely. And in 25 years, near enough to, here we go. And that is unbelievable.
It is.
To actually get a series finale given its own. I mean, we've seen it in other examples. Farscape, we mentioned earlier. It died season 4. It got its Peacekeeper Wars, which just pretty much wrapped up everything. So it does occasionally happen. But as you say, for the futurative model, it just doesn't had, as I think in part of what you've said as well, is it's never had the popularity. It's perhaps become such a format, so formulaic, that those examples of where it's not finished have never required returning to.
Right, absolutely. Starman in the 80s was somewhat popular, and you know, it certainly had a, and by that I guess I mean I'm saying it had a cult following. You know, and they campaigned, you know, to bring it back, but were not successful. But yeah, I mean, most of the time, you know, nobody is really out there, you know, pushing for the Phoenix to come back, you know, to find out what happened to Judson Scott or the Immortal. Worst TV show title ever. What did it last, like 12, you know, one season? The Immortal. We made it one season and that was it. Run, Joe, run. We never found out what happened to that poor dog.
I know. It's just one of those sort of things where you kind of hope that either one day there will be revivals, or whether in heaven there's just a plethora of final episodes which just never got made but are somehow cosmically recreated for your enjoyment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you always – that's it. I guess it's incumbent on us as lovers of cult television to at least mentally give those poor – men and or canines on the run, you know, sort of the mental space to say they made it, to you know, rest in peace. They achieved what they set out to do, because TV certainly didn't help us do that.
That's the sad thing about television. It pulls us in and then mercilessly tears away our endings, as I'm sure all of us have suffered in so many cases. So I think we'll leave it there.
Sounds good.
That's been a nice long podcast. I'm praying it has recorded. Because, of course, that sometimes is a horror. I'm not sure what we'll talk about next time. We have talked about, maybe we'll talk about Incredible Hulk. Maybe go on to Kenneth Johnson, Incredible Hulk, things like V as well. Whether they sit together, I don't know. Well, they could do podcasts on their own as well. But we will do another one. This has been the third. We look forward to seeing... We don't see or hear you, do we? It's a very null sensory experience from this end. We touch none of your senses. You touch none of our senses, is what I'm saying. That's kind of creepy. But we will see you for the fourth one in this ongoing season. I'm sure the finale one that we'll do will be cancelled before. just in the spirit of things.
I'm going on the run, James. That's it. I'm.
that'd be something I'd like to see. A blog in each town.